Oh, hello. Are you Jonathan Mitchell?
Yeah. Who are you?
Hi. I can't tell you that.
You can't tell me. You're in my apartment now. You just crawled through my window, and you can't tell me who you are.
But if I told you, I'd have to do something to distract you from my name. I'm just here incognito. I just come to give you a message.
A message.
So, yes, I have a complaint. Okay, Mr. Mitchell.
You know, I'm just trying to eat my dinner here, so maybe...
Yeah, I see that. It looks lovely.
Did you make that yourself? It's a Blue Apron meal, actually.
It is. Yeah. I wondered if you'd get that in there or not. Never mind. Okay, do you mind if I join you for...
Yeah. How did you get in my house?
Oh, yeah. I just crawled up the drain pipe and...
I actually live in an apartment, by the way, on the 12th floor, so... It's a pretty long climb.
I've got good upper body strength. But listen, the reason why I'm here is you have misled me, Mr. Mitchell.
I misled you? How did I mislead you?
I've done some research, and, you know, it's just not the truth, is it? It's not the truth. It's not the actual, real, proper... These things didn't happen.
That's just the name. That's the name of the show. It's like there's truth in fiction. And it's like there's this Ralph Waldo Emerson quote that goes...
Don't nearly raise your voice at me, sir. You're getting cross with me because I have found you out, huh? Now, I know why you're cross like this, because you can't handle the truth. Can't handle the truth.
Sarah?
You can't handle...
Is this the best guess you could come up with?
Yes, sorry. You know, just always wait to say that. you can't handle the truth. This is gritting with his teeth. Okay, so shall we just get on with the interview?
Maybe? Yeah, I think we should. Welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast on the Audio Drama Network. I'm Jonathan Mitchell.
And I'm Sarah Golding. And this episode is all about the Anthology Podcast, how Jonathan finds and shapes unique, brilliant, and thought-provoking stories on the Truth Podcast, and how he makes it so awesome every single time. So welcome, Jonathan. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you.
How do you do it? This is what people are asking. What is your secret? Your podcast is truly, it's one of my top favorites when it comes. I've listened to it straight away without even knowing sometimes. And for those that don't know, it's called The Truth. And so what's your favorite hook line to describe it? How would you pitch it out?
So, well, what's on our website, it says movies for your ears, but that's not my favorite way to describe it. I don't think actually I found a way that I really love that I just to describe it, but lately we've been saying original short stories in audio, but the way that I think of it is they're like short films but without pictures, and I try to push the musicality of it.
Superb. Yes, because that's his key, I think. Yeah, the way you tell the stories, I mean, can you talk us a little bit through how you work your timeline for production initially, and how you choose them is something that people are asking. Like, where do you work with the writers? I've got lots of questions for you. So yes, you want to just start off with your process, really. How does each kind of series or season come to be?
So I have a group of writers that I work with, and also an associate producer, Carrie Kasten. And all of us meet together once a week on Friday mornings. And all the writers, there's five writers right now. And they're all working on stories. And what happens is a writer will pitch a story idea. Maybe what I ask them to do is bring in 3 to 5 ideas. And they pitch a bunch of ideas. And we try to find one idea that we feel like really strong about, and we talk about them in the group. We kind of bounce around like what of the ideas, what we think of each idea. And sometimes that results in we say, come back next week with more ideas. But sometimes there's like one idea that just stands out and it's like, okay, that really feels like an audio piece. Sometimes there's an idea that has a kernel of something really, really interesting, but it's not quite what they pitched. And so we talk through it and try to find, arrive at an idea that we think will work. And so once we have the idea, then they'll come back the next week with usually an outline, sometimes a scene or two. It depends on how the writer likes to work.
So just to clarify, so you've got five writers in the room, but the person who pitches then goes to write that, or is somebody chosen?
Yeah, we're trying to find an idea for the writer to work on. So that's like they take ownership of that that piece, and it's their, it's their idea that we're kind of shaping at the pitch stage, and then they bring in sort of a first draft of an outline. Hopefully that's a complete outline. Sometimes they don't know how it's going to end, or sometimes they're just kind of feeling it out. But they'll come back the next week with some work done on it, and we talk through it and talk about how it's working and suggest things. You know, we make everyone talks about, responds to it, and it's very collaborative in that way. We everyone shares their ideas, and then it's ultimately at that stage, I like to leave it up to the writer to really decide what notes they're going to take. I mean, unless I feel really strongly like we shouldn't do that, I think that's not going to be an idea that I want to do. And sometimes that happens, but usually it's like, it's more a matter of like, well, I think this, and Lewis will say something he thinks, and we'll all like kind of be riffing off of it and maybe generating ideas and just trying to kind of do like a brainstorming, like idea dump, you know?
Exciting, yes.
And then it's up to the writer to decide what to do with that and what makes most sense to them, and how to process that and how to focus it. And hopefully they come back the next week with something much more focused that's maybe getting farther along. And we do that week after week until it's ready to record. And usually that process takes maybe 2 or 3 months. And so a lot of times at these meetings, I mean, they're 2 hours long, so we don't have time to talk about everyone's story, but I try to at least talk, like check in. And usually the first story we read through is the one that's coming up next and is the farthest along, and we have table reads where everyone is assigned a part and we read through it, and I'll record it sometimes just to get a sense of how long it is, but you know, in case we want, like I record all our meetings, and we kind of rotate the pieces in and out, and at a certain point, if we feel like the idea really has legs and it's going to work out, we assign a date to it, you know, a drop date. We're usually thinking about 2 months ahead. And the idea is that since our podcast goes up every 2 weeks, we like to have the script done 3 weeks before it's going to go up, and then record that week before the previous piece goes up, you know, so that when one piece is finished, I have the tape already for the next piece to start editing it.
Perpetual excitement then in your avenue. Very exciting. Yeah. With regards to your seasons, how long are your seasons generally?
Usually we start around in September and then we'll go to June. I mean, it's sort of varied year to year. It's kind of, you know, we've had different things. I mean, it's not consistent, but right now we started this season in September. We took a break in December and January, and we just came back with a bunch of new pieces, and we're going to go every 2 weeks until June. And they didn't take 2 months off.
And do you know where your writers get their inspiration from? I mean, because people are asking, like, how do you decide on your story? So is there any things that you're drawn to for inspiration for these specific kind of anthology stories?
I'm not sure. To be honest, I think you'd have to talk to them.
Yes.
They bring a bunch of ideas. Some of them, like, for example, the one that just went up last night was called The Co-op. And that was by Becca Shawl. She lives in a co-op. And I think that story was inspired by her experience of moving into a co-op and going through the interview process and all that. And it sort of gave her these ideas for that she thought she could heighten into an interesting horror story.
Yes, because it's had shades of Rosemary's Baby in some respects for me.
It's definitely got I think of that story as a cross between Rosemary's Baby and Darren Aronofsky's Mother. I mean, for the pieces, what I like to do is I like to think of the show as a speculative fiction show. And so there's usually one element that couldn't happen in the real world, like some magical element or some sci-fi or some horror, some like maybe it's an alternate history. But the rest of the story is played out as realistically as we can So it's one piece of magic in a very realistic setting.
I think that's why I love it, because I guess in our real life, sometimes there's a bit of magic missing. So it's nice to hear about it. But yeah.
And it gives them like a metaphorical kind of way of exploring the world that's not a literal. It gives you a different perspective on life that lets you kind of explore it hopefully a fresh way.
Yes. Yeah. It's almost like you're sort of jumping in and watching these whatever events they are unfolding, but quite intimately sometimes. Because I was thinking when I was listening a couple of episodes ago, actually, it's just that moment where almost like it's that audio close-up, I think, that you've got going on somehow, that kind of really hones in on these people's either thoughts or their sort of minimal conversations. And I mean, can you give an idea of how you've used and what you do to create that intimacy in your pieces?
Well, I like to work a lot with depth in the recording, you know, mic distance and where the listener is in relation to the person who's talking. And what I do, there's a couple of different ways to do that, but generally what I like to do is I record with close mics on the actors and then a stereo mic a few feet back, and I record to multi-track so that it all stays in sync. And it's creating the sense of depth that I want is a question of how those mics are mixed, those two mics. There's ways that the actors can play to the mic or away from the mic. That's kind of gives a nice, you know, sense of movement or perspective on where they are. For example, in this story that just went up last night, there's a scene where they discover their neighbor is in their apartment. And at first he's far away and he's like kind of looking for a screwdriver. And at a certain point, about halfway through the scene, he walks up and is like right in their face. And the actor got a little bit closer to the microphone I had him. I had that stereo mic and the close mic, and the close mic was maybe about a foot and a half away for the first part of the scene. And then he got up really close, like about, I don't know, with these microphones, it takes about 6 inches. And so he was modulating his distance from the mic. And then what I do in the mixing is it's about, you know, like in the first part of the scene, I de-emphasize the close mic. And then in the second part of the scene, I de-emphasize the stereo mic. And so it creates the illusion that they're coming closer to you.
So we've got up to the point where you've got the potential scripts to work on. You've potentially worked out when you're going to record it. So what happens from there? How does it get cast? How do you sound design and so on before? How do you prepare for production?
So casting, usually, sometimes we have an actor in mind when we're working on the script. At a certain point, we start to talk about, you know, start to bounce around. Well, who is this person? And like, what actors do we know who could play this part? And the writers I work with, I think they all seem to like sort of have their own circles of performers that they know. You know, they kind of travel in these different groups. Like Chris Kopeniak has done a lot of stage work, and he's done some television, and he does a lot of books on tape. And so he knows a lot of actors through that. But Lewis Kornfeld, on the other hand, he teaches at Magnet, and he has a lot of students who are improv, do a lot of improv, and he knows all the improvisers at the theater.
Yes.
And so he can suggest from there.
So that's the place to go, folks. Yeah, if you want to get in.
Yeah. And then Carrie Kasten has a background in off-Broadway theater in New York and Brooklyn, and so she's encountered and worked with a lot of different actors that way. She also actually happens to work in a law office where a lot of actors have day jobs.
Ah, yes.
So actually, we've cast
a few
people.
You sound lovely. Come and join us on this.
They're really good actors often, and we've cast a few. In fact, we worked with one of them today, who's a really amazing actor named Billy Griffin Jr.
Fun to watch.
Who's been in a couple of our pieces already. But he was in an episode of Black Mirror.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I do love that. I think anyone who doesn't is strange. I think that's one of the best things on TV currently.
Yeah.
Well, not currently, generally.
So we talk about people that everyone knows, and people recommend different people based on who they've worked with. And we'll sit and look at videos online. You know, while we're talking about this, if someone brings up a name, oh, what about so-and-so? And then we try to find they're real, and we listen to it. Like, oh, that's that person's great. That person's perfect. Or no. You know, it's like, it's usually you can tell if you want to audition them. And then Carrie sets up auditions, and I interview people over the phone. I'll talk to them about the story, and we'll read through a few scenes together. I usually audition maybe 3 or 4 people for a part, but it depends. sometimes it's harder to cast for whatever reason.
But just out of interest, for that audition, how much do you direct them over the phone and ask them to do things in different ways? Are you quite proactive?
I don't do it a lot. I mean, we'll do it maybe at most two or three times. I do have them oftentimes try to do an improv-y take just to see where they're at with improv. I mean, it's hard to do because usually it's very challenging for them, because really to do it right, you have to really know the scene well. And usually they've maybe read it a couple times. But I understand that, and I tell them, like, I get it, that, you know, you don't know the scene really well enough to do this well, but I just want to kind of get a sense of where you're at. And so we do try that, but it depends on how serious I am about casting them, really. You know, like, sometimes I just kind of want to get a sense of how their voice sounds or how well they act.
Yes, it's quite important, I guess, when it's just the voice in the void.
Yeah.
And with regards to that, do you take into account the different kind of tones, timbres, and all that, the, you know, pace that people speak at? Do you make a choice based on that with the other actors in mind, or is it?
Yes, it's really crucial how their voices sound in combination. Like, I really try to avoid voices that are similar. Like, I think in terms of, like, well, this person has a high voice, this person has a low voice, this person has a very distinctive voice, this person, you know, like, I try to make sure that each part could not be mistaken for another. Usually when I don't do it as well as I wished I had, you know, like when I'm editing the tape, I'm like, oh gosh, I wish I had cast someone else because these two people sound exactly the same. But that's something when I do encounter it, it causes enough consternation that it's something that I really look out for, because I know how hard it can make things. Yeah. So once we cast the actors and we try to figure out a time when everyone's available and the studio is available, we try to do every story in either two or three recording sessions.
Of how
so
long?
So the recording the sessions usually go for about 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So
and that's
six
for
to
around
nine
a,
hours.
It's around a 20-minute podcast, isn't it, generally?
Yeah, 15 minutes, I'd say.
Right,
is the average length of the stories.
Superb. So these people have been cast, they've been called to the studio. How much rehearsal do you use before you start to record?
I record the rehearsals. So, I mean, we just rehearse in the session. We'll do three takes where we're learning the script and just getting the dialogue. It depends on the actor, you know. Some actors are just so good that you don't feel like you need to get a lot of takes out of them. Mm-hmm. Some of them you really want to loosen up. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's like massaging the actor into into the part.
That sounds nice.
And getting it, yeah. It's like you're getting it so that they don't have to think about the words, you know, so much.
I mean, you expect them to have learnt it coming into the rehearsal, into the performance.
It's nice when they have, but I usually assume that they haven't.
See, that's the joys of voice acting, isn't it?
It's unusual for them to know very much about it. I don't know. I honestly don't know how much they prepare before they get there, but it would be nice if they did.
That's a big hint. Gentle
hint. What we do is, so we do like three rehearsal takes, and then we'll try to get to the point in the next three takes where they can do it from memory. So I break the script down into sort of manageable chunks, like of about a page to a page and a half each. And so it's like not a lot of dialogue at one time. It's just like it's a sequence, you know, and usually it's short enough that they can, after they've done it a few times, they can pretty much do it from memory. They know what's there. So we do it from memory a few times, and all the while we're kind of making adjustments and talking about what the characters are thinking and where they're coming from and why that line of dialogue is there and why the character is saying it.
And are these done statically? Sorry to interrupt. Are these done statically, or they are moving in the space as if they were in the situations they're in?
They're moving around to the extent that it helps to tell the story. I have usually it depends on the story, it depends on the scene, but usually I do have the actors move around a lot, and I like to use the space. I feel like I've gotten better at knowing how I need to record it in order to create the sense of movement that I want. Like, they don't have to do everything literally. I think in the beginning I may have done stuff more, I've been more literal about what the actors were doing, and now I'm more like, okay, if I record it this way and I have the actor stand over here, I know that I can create this effect. And so I have them moving around. If their character is laying in bed, for example, I'll have them laying down in bed because I feel like that affects the sound of their voice. If they're standing up, then I'll, or sitting down, that's what they're doing. You know, I like to sometimes, oftentimes in the course of a scene, they start at sitting down and then they get up and walk out of the room or something, still talking. And I like to have moments like that, especially when it reinforces the dramatic intent of the scene. And so all the movement is usually meant to reinforce emotional beats in the story. And so I'm thinking about where the actor's placed and how we can create an effect of movement. Most interior scenes nowadays I'll record in a studio. If it's a car scene, I almost always record it in a car.
Yes.
Because I feel like that's like a very particular space that is hard to fake.
Yes.
And then also I think similarly outdoor scenes are very difficult to fake.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like to go outside.
Yes.
That somewhat, because I'm in New York, that can limit the kinds of outdoor
yes, of
scenes
course.
We have.
Lots of ambient noise.
It's like impossible to get away from traffic here. Mm-hmm. So it's a real special thing to have a story that's outside, that doesn't involve traffic.
Yes.
Like we have to like make an effort. And mm-hmm. so we don't do it very often.
Mm-hmm.
So those are basically the three settings that we'll record as a car, outside, or in a studio. Sometimes I record at my apartment. Like this last story, I wanted to get them walking. Like there's a sequence where they're walking through and looking at different parts of the house. And I wanted to, because there's different sized rooms, I like to get that sound of actors going from a really small space to a very big space in the middle of a conversation.
So with regards to actually the location work, so you've got that 2-3 hour slot with the actors. How do you work out what you're going to do and when? Because you say you structured the day. So just to give people an idea of, like, do you do your location work first and then come back in? Or do you know what I mean? Is there a most efficient way of working that you've found if you've got a multitude of things to get done?
Usually I do all the, like if it's in a studio, I do all the studio stuff on one day. And then if I'm going to have outdoor scenes, I'll do that on a different day. Usually, a lot of times, the outdoor stuff, it's very common for it to be just like one or two sequences. And so it's just I'll have the actors come by for an hour one afternoon and we'll do it then. The car stuff tends to be a lot longer. And so we'll schedule like 2 hours. Sometimes like 2 hours in a car and then an hour in my apartment. Like that's what we did. There's a piece called Magic Hugs that had both those types of scenes. We did a lot of that in a studio, but then we had a car scene and then we had this hotel scene that we did in my living room. It's like, because usually when we have a car scene, we'll park the car about a block away from my apartment so that we can come back to my place and do some more stuff here.
Oh no, my parking space is gone. Yes.
Cool. But usually I divide I separate the studio stuff from the location.
And as a director and producer, can you give us an example of where your direction has really pulled out a really good, you think, performance from an actor? It was probably already good in the first place, but something that you've done as a director to really eke out something truly cool.
I don't know if I'm the world's greatest director. I feel like I'm getting better. So it's hard to say that without thinking, gosh, you know, I don't know if that's so brilliant. But I remember one time there was a piece called Sylvia's Blood where the main character is Andy Moskowitz was the actor and he was doing narration.
Mm-hmm.
The story has a lot of very fantastical elements to it. And I didn't want it to feel hokey, like the character was believing something that we couldn't really believe. You know, it was really important that it be delivered in a way, because he's describing a lot of things that don't exist in the real world and are a little bit over the top in that way. In order for the audience to buy into it, it was important that it not sound like he's, you know, he believes something that I don't believe he would believe.
Okay,
you know?
So we have to invest in what he's doing and saying.
And so the way that we handled it was, the direction I gave him was to do it as though you're being interrogated by cops and they don't believe you. And so you have to convince them, because that's the position that the audience is in. They're coming into this with skepticism. They don't believe what you're saying. And so you have to acknowledge, if you acknowledge that they don't believe you, that kind of gives you the power to like, no, you got it. like, I'm serious, you know. And then it kind of gives his character this sense of desperation, and it adds stakes to his performance too. Like because he's doing it in his mind to cops, who don't believe him. If he has to get them to believe him somehow. You know, if you've ever tried to convince someone of something they did not believe, you know, how do you make them believe you? That was the challenge he had. So, by thinking of it that way, I think it got to a performance that was easier to buy into.
So everyone should go listen to that if they haven't already, Sylvia's Blood. also, with your kind of director's head, what role do you have in that rehearsal room? Is it your show, you do it, and you're kind of leading everything? Or is there someone else in there with you also kind of working the room in different ways?
I love to have the writer of the piece in the recording session with me.
Great.
Because oftentimes they've been thinking about the character in ways that we haven't even talked about in the writing meetings, you know? Like, they're much more detailed about where the characters are coming from and why they're saying these things. And if there's a line that the actor doesn't understand, or I feel like the actor isn't quite doing in a way that works, I'll turn to the writer and say, what is this character thinking right now? Why are they saying this? And then they'll usually have an answer. And so that helps the actor get to the performance. They also, like, oftentimes at the end of a take, the writer will have notes too. I love to have them feel free to say whatever they feel.
Okay.
Cool. About the
could be dangerous. Yeah.
no. Cool. It can, yeah. It can be. Hopefully, they don't contradict something that I say. But if I disagree with them, that's okay. I mean, we can do it their way, and then we'll do it a different way. And I have both ways. And oftentimes, what I think in this session, when I go back and hear the tape, I was like, oh no, they were right. You know, that's the way to do it. And so, you know, I like to have those options, because I always hear the tape differently when I'm editing it.
Yep.
I always have a much different perspective on things.
Yes.
And I hear things that I totally missed. I try to get options when in doubt. Get options.
Because I have a question for you, because I put out a call for some questions, and Abby Zeev says, I know Jonathan uses multiple improvised takes to create material for editing into the final product. I'm interested in hearing about the improvisation process. How much guidance and freedom is imposed or granted, and just anything else about this aspect of your process?
First of all, I like to, I find it works best when you work with actors or performers who are primarily improvisers. Like, that's how they define themselves, or that's the thing that they do the most. Like, they perform maybe at least one night, maybe several nights a week on stage in front of an audience.
Yes.
Improvising.
Fearless
they,
people.
maybe they teach improv oftentimes, or they've been studying it for years and years. And so usually those performers give you different, much better improv. Like I found that most actors will tell you that they can improvise, but the ones whose primary creative outlet is improv give you a completely different, like, much higher level of material when they improvise. So that's number one.
So get to those improvisation classes, people. Quick.
Find one. Yeah, or cast. If you feel like you're going to be relying heavily on improv in the story, I would say think about that when you're casting. Cast people who are particularly good at that. And then in the session, usually what we do these days is, because I found that when we script things out, we can do much more sophisticated storytelling. I mean, we have done fully improvised things or very, very loosely outlined things. And I like how they turn out, but there's less options for what we can do that way in terms of how we use the medium particularly. I've done more and more as the years have gone by. We just do more and more fully scripted things. But the way that I like to do it is have the actors memorize it and then give them a take. And then, like, first I'll give them a take where I say, okay, just, you know, be a little bit looser with your fidelity to the way it's worded in the script. You know, you can change up the wording if you want, if it feels more comfortable to say it a certain way. If there is a thing in the script that you're always having problems whenever you get there, just say it however you want. You know, don't go too far away from the script, but just kind of loosen it up a little bit in terms of what words you're choosing. And so we do maybe two or three takes like that, and we'll usually get some pretty good moments that way. And then I'll have them do a free take where I'll say, okay, I like everything we have so far. I feel like we've got enough material to edit the scene together. Let's just do a free take. You know, it's like there's no pressure. We're not trying to get something we can't figure out. We're just going to see what we can do with this now that we are comfortable with it. And so they do a take, and I can use it or not, but oftentimes the best material comes this way. Yes. A lot of times it's just like a moment. Even if like in a take I only use one interaction, I feel like it was worth it.
Yeah.
And so we do that two or three times it depends on how much time we have the studio for, we need to kind of get a lot of stuff done, then I might not do it as many times, but I like to do it two or three times. Uh-huh. Then I have 10 takes of the scene when I'm editing it, and I just stitch it together from all of the different takes. Like I don't feel I could, if I wanted to, if I felt like it was the best take, I could use mostly lines from the very first take and not use any of the improv stuff. But usually I don't feel that way. Usually I feel like the stuff with that towards the end where they were improvising more has more life to it. There's something about it where they were listening more.
Do you know, like, that like is so key, just you saying that, listening more, because that is what I think is missing from quite a lot of audio dramas, that being a remote actor, I can do my very best to imagine how I'm reacting to someone, but there's nothing like having the person there to actually react to. And
and having to listen, listen in order to understand how you're going to respond.
Yes.
You know, like that's one of the nice things about improv is it puts this unpredictability into the interaction where the person is forced to listen to you. Just to keep up with what's going on in the scene. And so that stuff has like a real life to it that it's hard to get in any other way. And I like to hear actors, you know, talk over one another and that kind of stuff and use their voices in ways that aren't like strictly linguistic.
Yeah, the pace of your pieces is always on point. It's like it is, that is a dynamic to it, and everything seems like it should be there. It's quite it's a condensed podcast in a way, because as you say, it's like 15 minutes is average. And I love the fact as well that it sometimes when it ends, you kind of, you're imagining what's going to happen next, and you so want to know what happens next. You kind of can invent your own next day kind of scenarios or next moment. So yeah, I really love that about it. I mean, with the creation process, have you ever, you've recorded something, but actually you've pulled it back from what was actually written and stopped it earlier than you perhaps initially intended? Have you ever done anything like that?
Usually it's the opposite. Usually we start it later than the actor or than the writer had been thinking. Like I'll say, we don't need these two scenes. We'll start it here.
So it's like that, losing that first chapter of your written novel, isn't it? I suppose.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that's
all. Yeah, that's my preference.
Character setting and so on. And grand. Cool.
Yeah.
And
get into the conflict.
What's the problem?
Enough to understand who the character is and what their deal is on a normal day, and then make that day abnormal.
Yes,
somehow.
Well, something's at stake. Something's not right. Yes, exciting.
Yeah.
Cool. So, with regards to then next steps, so you've managed to record over however many sessions. What happens next?
I take the tape and I load it all into Pro Tools, and what I'll do is I'll do several passes. The first pass, I'll take out anything in the scene, any line of dialogue that I might use. If I'm not sure, I'll pull it. I only don't include things that I know I don't like, you know. And so usually I end up with most of the stuff we recorded. But what I've done is I've put an edit between each line of dialogue. So even if I'm going to use, like, say, let's say from a certain take, I might use three or four lines in a row. I like how this entire interaction went. I'll still put an edit between each line of dialogue. And then I'll take all of the things that I've pulled from all of the takes, and I put the lines of dialogue in chronological order, so that I have, maybe I might have four or five takes of the same line of dialogue in a row. And then I have maybe three, four, five takes of the next line of dialogue all in a row. And so it goes through the entire scene like that, where I'll have every single take I like of a particular line in order. And so then from there, that's like the really tedious part. From there, it gets really easy, because then I just go through and I listen to every single take of a line and I pick out the one I like. And sometimes at this stage, especially if I have a lot of takes that I like to choose from, I might pull down, say, two or three, but I usually don't pull down more than three takes of a particular line at this point. So I try to really narrow down to one or two takes of every line in the scene. And then I kind of do another pass at it. So then I'll pick out from the ones that I thought were really choice, really good, I'll pick out, maybe it'll be between two or three, and I'll make decisions about what I think it should be.
Yes.
Then usually I'll just have the scene, but it won't be, the timing of it won't be right. It'll just be every line of dialogue in order.
Uh-huh.
I play around with it, and I start changing the timing of it and make it sound like a real conversation. Give it a nice ebb and flow and try to make it feel like a scene, you know. And then usually when I'm doing that, I discover that a take that I chose doesn't work. It just was the wrong choice. And I'll go back and I'll find a different take. A lot of times, you know, it's very, very common. I do this in almost every scene I edit. I'll like Frankenstein lines of dialogue together, where maybe I'll have three different takes all edited to make the make it really how I want. Like, I like the beginning of one take and the end of another. So we just edit them together. And then I live with it for a while in the piece, and I work on other scenes. And usually as you're working on the piece, you hear things over and over again. And usually it takes that kind of repeated listening for this one thing just always bugs me every time I hear it. That bugs me. And then you go out and you fix it. You try to fix it. It's a living thing, you know. I'm not done with it until it's, you know, up on iTunes or whatever, you know, and you're constantly revising it and trying to make it better and smooth it out. I've done this a lot of different ways, but I try to start sound designing fairly early. A lot of times I'll sound design maybe the first scene early on just to kind of get a sense of what the tone of the story is going to be. Like I might have an edited version of the first scene. And then just to, like, a lot of times, for example, I want to make sure it's going to sound right, like I recorded it right. Or like if maybe I have doubts about some recording choice I made, I might just mix it a little bit just to make sure it's going to work. I might sound design that first sequence just to get a sense of what the tone of the story is. And so then I'll edit the rest of the story without sound designing it. I'll get all the dialogue so that I can then, because at a certain point, like I'm always working under deadline. And if you have too much unfinished stuff, if you have like two scenes that you haven't even touched, it gets really stressful the closer you get to the deadline. And so if I can get all the way through the piece and get like a nice rough edit of the whole thing by like a week before it's going to go up, then I feel comfortable. And then I can really,
it's wiggle room.
Then I can spend the next few days just sound designing and doing like two or three scenes a day.
And how do you do that? What's your technique and what's your top tips for folks who are at that stage of doing something?
I usually have a particular image I'm trying to create in people's heads. I use convolution reverb in combination with real environments. Like if I use a lot of sound effects, you know, if a scene's out in the city, I'll even if we recorded it outside, I'll still add a layer of
soundscape,
of city ambiance.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's inside, like if they're in an apartment and they're living in the city, I have like room tones of apartments and cities. Even if I literally recorded it in my apartment, I'll still add a layer of this room tone, cars going by and sirens or whatever, because I feel like it smooths out the editing. It oftentimes helps mask maybe inconsistencies. For me, what one of the big tricks is that I'll then apply a very mild convolution reverb to the entire mix, including the ambience that, it, you know, the canned ambience, so that it's giving it all a sense of the same space, but very subtly, nothing too dramatic, just something to kind of like emulsify it. So that's how I deal with very basic traditional sound design. Music is a little bit more intuitive. I like to have a very strong sense of purpose to every musical choice I make.
I absolutely love that. It really gives a distinctive feel to each piece. And Kevin Hartnell actually had a question. He said, Jonathan is absolutely masterful at knowing when to use music and how to blend sound design, music and voices together. Can you ask him on how he developed this particular skill? So where did you get it from? How do you have this amazing ability to pull that all together?
I studied music in school.
Uh-huh.
That might have something to do with it. But I don't know if it has a lot to do with it. I mean, I write music, and I've I've done scores and things like that. Mm-hmm. But
does your music go into your original music as well?
I do write music for the show, mm-hmm. although not as much as I used to. Mm-hmm. It depends on the situation. Sometimes it's faster for me to just to do it on my own.
Yeah, I can do that with a kazoo and the spoons. So if anyone needs kazoo and spoons for any soundtrack, just ask.
Right. Like if it's like a really custom thing, then I'll do it on my own. But I think, I mean, I worked in radio for years. Since the mid-90s, and I've sound designed all kinds of pieces. It's always been something like, that's how I made my living from a very early point in my career. That was always the thing that got me jobs, was how I was able to use music.
So it's experience, and,
It was like, it came naturally to me at first, and I think to the point where I got lots of opportunities to develop that. And over time, you know, you develop a really strong sense of what you like and what you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
and I like things, I like it to have a sense of purpose. I don't like it to be too indulgent.
It's almost like the music side of things is another voice, isn't it, in telling the story.
Or it's like it's giving you a particular perspective on the scene. Mm. It's saying that the scene means something.
Yes.
It can be an ironic perspective on the scene that's completely different than what it actually means in the story. You know, it could be very happy music, but the fact that it's happy music is like super dark,
yeah,
you know?
Signposting in a different way, yes.
Because it's fresh in my head, the story that just went up last night, that's what I did in the last scene. It's at this, it's a really kind of dark, I think of it as a horror story.
Mm, it is, yeah.
But the last scene, or the second to last scene, is at a party, and they're playing this music that's just like this very, I don't know, I guess I think of it as kind of new agey kind of music, you know, very a little bit ambient and like harps. And it was funny because it was like threading a needle of doing that without being off-puttingly cheesy. You know, I didn't want it to be off-putting. I want it to be actually good music, but it's sort of referencing a lot of really bad music.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah. No, you have to listen to make up your own mind and see.
Yeah. But that's how I think of it anyway. But at the end of the scene, like they're basically this group of people in a way, in a sense, it's like they're stealing the souls of the main characters.
Oh, spoilers, and, spoilers.
yeah, this is a spoiler. So you might tell people to listen to this piece before the episode. Anyway, instead of going like, I at a certain point, like when we were working on the script, I was always thinking, oh, well, this is the part of the scene where I'll start like making the pitch of the music go down and put all kinds of like, you know, dissonant,
sinister element.
Tones and stuff in into the mix and give it this really creepy kind of like haunted house kind of feel. And when I got to it, when I was doing it, I found that if I left that music going, actually the music that I chose had this really ornate harp gestures at the end of it. It just went with the scene in like the opposite way than it actually means in the story, if you know what I mean. It's like reinforcing the antagonist's point of view, you know. And it also, not only that, but it also, I feel like it calls back to this, there's this like garden theme in the story. Like they have this herb garden, and the people who live in this co-op are strangely fixated on their herb garden. And so I felt like the harp gestures kind of were very evocative of vines that were kind of like growing around this couple.
Yes, I was going to say that did very much feel like they are trapped now. There's no way they're going to be able to leave.
Yeah, it engulfs them.
Yes.
They just get subsumed into the place.
Yes.
That's the kind of thing I'm thinking about when we choose music. And a lot of times also, I mean, there's like the diegetic music still has an emotional relationship to the scene. You want to choose music that reinforces a certain tone or mood or says something about the environment they're in that's really important to the story. It's all chosen very specifically.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, it's either working with or it's showing a change in the scenario or working against it. So there's lots of ways to implement and use it.
One other thing I might add is that I also think a lot about how the text plays over the music, like where certain musical moments or beats or section changes happen in relation to the talking and the story and the dialogue. And I want them to all be working together. Like the way I think of it is when you add music to a story, you're essentially creating a new piece of music. The talking in the story becomes an element in the music that you're creating. It's like when a hip-hop artist takes a beat from another song and then starts rapping over it. that's essentially what we're doing when we put music into a story.
Beautiful. Now, I have a couple of other questions. This is from Matthew Boudreau from Oral Stage Studios. The Truth is one of a handful of shows that I find uses narration effectively as setup and transition rather than as a means to provide overtly expository information that can otherwise be evoked through scene. I'm curious how Jonathan manages to find a balance between show, don't tell storytelling and outright telling the audience through narration.
It's been such a long... Decider, I guess, didn't really use narration. That was like a first person. That was unusual for us, the Decider, because she's talking in the first person.
Yes.
Thing. She's saying things that would be in her head, but she's doing it out loud. She's not doing it. We're like, there's no like heavy reverb on it or anything like that. It feels very natural that she would be saying these things. I mean, some writers do this naturally. You don't have to give them the direction. It depends on the writer. But, you know, a lot of times there'll be a dialogue line that's like, this person, this character is saying this because the writer wants me to know it. The character doesn't care if I know this or not. You know, what is the character thinking? What would the character really say in this situation? And you try to make it so that the dialogue feels like legitimately and naturally what the character would say in that moment, given their mindset and what's happening in the scene. Usually, for me, expository dialogue is the result of the writer trying to talk through the actors, you know, and giving them things to say that they normally wouldn't say in that scene. And I found that if you just have the actors say what they would actually say in that situation, like the exposition finds a way to bubble through that, you know?
Yeah.
Like you find that it kind of weeds out the stuff you don't need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Like the stuff that's left over, a lot of times it ends up being all you really do need to know. And like there's a nice sense of ambiguity to having to figure out, like being a little bit disoriented at first in a scene and not knowing where the characters are, or learning something when they say something a little bit later on in the scene. Oh, it turns out they're actually in a bar. I thought that they were, you know, whatever. I like that. And I feel like it's not necessary. You only have to explain enough to make the piece not confusing.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that people have asked us about, is just that how do you signpost things very clearly? Any top tips for that?
My strategy is to have the dialogue, the characters only say what they need to say. Like, if you were this character, what would you say? Don't put anything more than that. And then we look at the scene and we say, okay, what's not coming across? And then we kind of try to think creatively about where it makes logical sense for that information. How could that information be conveyed? What's confusing about this scene? What you know, a lot of times it boils down to just a single word being said. Like somewhere in this scene, the word camera has to be said. Otherwise, I'm not going to know what that sound is. And if you could just say, just work the word camera in somehow, you know.
Yes.
And it's a lot easier to do it if it's just like one word. A lot of times, like when I'm working with the actors, it's a lot of that kind of stuff where you can say whatever you want, but just make sure you say this at some point. Just find a way to say that. I think it's really about the motivation of the character. It's about like what is the character trying to accomplish by saying this? And if that feels organic to the story and natural given the situation, then it'll work. Yeah, it's hard to talk about in the abstract. It's much easier to look at a specific example.
I have another question here from Philip Thorne from the Amelia podcast, which I hope you listen to because that's fab. The truth spans very wide in terms of genre. Thoughts on how to cultivate an audience without a clear formal framework? So basically talking about not having a series and you having the anthology kind of set up. So how far are audience willing to go with you? Do you need to constantly find new audiences if you change up the form?
I feel like we've been really lucky. I think if I were starting the show now, I don't know if I'd be able to have such a varied format.
Okay.
And get an audience.
Interesting. Yeah. Why? Why is that?
I think that anthology shows, it's easier to build an audience if you have a real strong hook. Like there's something that unifies it. Like they all take place in this hotel or they, you know, like High Maintenance, I think, has one of the best conceits of an anthology series.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like at the beginning when we started the show, I didn't know what I wanted it to be. I just wanted to be able to try lots of different things.
Tell
I didn't
stories.
Want to be locked into yeah. any, yeah. Yeah, I didn't want to be locked into any one genre mm-hmm. or any one setting or any one set of characters. I just wanted to, like, at that time, I mean, a lot less audio drama was being made at that time. I didn't want to limit myself. I wanted to kind of plant lots of seeds and see what all I could do. And I thought, well, by doing that, one of them might take hold, and I might discover, okay, this is an idea that has a lot of legs, and I'm just going to land on that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, the closest thing to that that's happened is at a certain point, I said, well, I really seem to like the stories that are speculative fiction a little bit more, because I feel like it gives me a sonic in, you know, like there's a lot of times it's easier to find the sound of the story. But a lot of times the writers I work with would really not rather be doing speculative fiction, or they find that too limiting. And it's, and so they'll always try to sneak stuff in. Like Lewis especially, like we just did this story, Mall Santa. That's not a speculative fiction story.
Uh-huh.
But we did it. And Magic Hugs is sort of borderline. It's basically not a speculative fiction story, although it kind of has a conceit that maybe you're not sure if it's true or not.
Yes,
so.
Yes.
But he's the one who most often comes in with ideas that are completely not. But I like the idea, so we do it anyway. And so it's like I'm still open to other things. But how do you build an audience around that? I feel like the audience that we have, I feel like there's a consistency in tone and acting style, and the way that sound is used, and sort of the production quality, that just the sound of the show tends to be consistent.
Yes, there's all of that, and is so, your brand, yes.
And so there's like an identity that's in that. Like there has to be some consistent element to the series. And if you can get away with having it be the production style, then I think that more power to you.
Yeah. Cool.
But it's hard to sell other people on that at the beginning.
I was going
to
say, how proactive have you been in marketing and social media, and who does that for you, firstly, from the initial point now?
The original motivation for starting the podcast was to try to get a radio show happening, try to get something on public radio. It was just like I was going to try to prove that there was an audience for this, and also have a way to practice, kind of get better at it. And I was really hungry to start working with performers and writers and developing stories and just doing it all the time and not having to wait around, but really being proactive.
Driving
about
yourself.
Making stuff.
Yeah.
And so podcasting gave an outlet for that, gave me a place to put that stuff. And so we started the feed, and we had a piece on This American Life just a few months in after we started.
Great.
That's one of the reasons I started the feed, actually, was because I knew that was going to happen.
Okay.
And so once that happened, then all of a sudden, like that week, we were the number one podcast on iTunes because our percentage of listeners jumped so high. And that lasted for a couple of weeks, and it got us all kinds of new listeners and a lot of interviews and attention and opportunities, and all kinds of things came out of that. It was a real like winning the lottery type of moment. Like it was very lucky.
And was it just you doing those and pursuing those interviews, or did you have a core team behind you?
People were coming to me. I didn't pursue anything at that point.
Amazing. Yeah.
In fact, I've done very little of that all along. People seem to. I mean, I may have been missing out, or maybe I would have far more listeners if I had. I don't know. But for better or for worse, I've just sort of the stuff I've done has come to me. And we kept going. We weren't making any money at this point. We didn't really, I mean, I think we started the podcast in February, and by August, I think PodTrack had sold an Amazon, I think it was Amazon, maybe it was Audible sponsorship that would only lasted for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. I didn't realize it was only going to last 2 or 3 weeks. I thought, hey, we're set now, you know, but no, they didn't sell anything. So they're gone. So, okay, I guess that's how that works, okay. You know? And plus, I mean, at that point, our audience wasn't like huge. It was big enough to attract a sponsor, but the money we were getting from it was not enough to really do what I felt like I wanted to be doing with it. And so it was essentially just me and the actors and the writers working for free and just trying to figure out a way to make money. I think about a year and a half into it, we had a fundraiser. My goal is to raise $30,000 so that I could not have to take freelance work and just sort of do it and really concentrate on doing it more often and just keep on it. Because in the beginning, also, I had this back catalog of pieces that I'd done just in my radio career. that I could sort of stick on the feed, mm-hmm. and that would buy us a couple weeks before we needed to put another story up.
Yes.
And after a while, that ran out.
Okay.
and so to do things every 2 weeks is very, very hard, especially if you're not getting paid for it. It's a very time consuming thing, especially the level of stories. Like the stories we do have a lot of sound design and take a lot of production. And it's just a lot, very time consuming. And so
yes, this is why I only put a 2 minute sketch at the front of this show.
Yeah, right. And so we raised this money, and right near the end of our fund drive period, I got an email from Roman Mars telling me that he was going to start a new podcast network with PRX, and did I want to be a part of it?
And Radiotopia. Like,
yes, yes, I do. Thank you.
How exciting! Yes.
And so I was really all this time. I was also kind of trying to court this other public radio distributor, APM, but they were taking a long time. I had Peter Clowney, who was there, was very supportive, and he's a big part of why the truth is around, is because he was there to support me during that period. And he was really enthusiastic about the idea and tried to get his bosses to buy into it. But it was very difficult for him to do that. They weren't responding. And so we went for a very long time trying to get them. And so by the time Roman came around, I was starting to think that the APM thing wouldn't happen, or I was getting frustrated. And so here's somebody who's actually seems legitimately interested in what I'm doing, versus this other place that
not really that much, yeah.
maybe they might be, but I don't know.
Yeah.
And so then they finally did come to me with an offer, but it was a week after Roman came to me.
too late.
It was a weird serendipitous kind of timing of things. Mm. And I went with Roman because it didn't take him a year and a half to say yes. And I thought that was important.
Yeah.
And I liked the other shows in the network. I thought it was a really good group of people that I thought it was a good audience, a good access to an audience that I thought would be go along with who I felt like my show might appeal to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What year is this now? Because you started going back. So
this would have been the beginning of 2014. Mm-hmm. Was when Radiotopia launched, and they were all almost all of the shows on that network were people I'd known for years from working in public radio.
Oh, really? So it's not what you know; it's who you know. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, but at the same time, when I met these people, podcasting didn't really exist, and it was just a matter of, it was really about trying to do good work and finding out like-minded people, we were friends because we were interested in this weird aspect of radio. We were we were just into doing, we really loved making radio.
Yes,
yes. And
you wanted to do it your way. And it's a group of people.
Yeah, and we had just been doing it for a while.
And can I just ask how much Radiotopia has made any difference to your show?
Since I joined, my audience has quintupled.
Amazing.
Yeah, it made it so that it's my full-time job.
Yes. Hooray! And everyone is dreaming of doing that all the time.
And
yes, me too.
And I have the money to hire an associate producer. And pay all of our actors and writers.
Superb. Which is how it should be, yes.
And pay for studio time and all that. Yes. And so,
amazing. So you're living the dream. You've done it. You're there.
I'm living my dream.
Beautifully
for sure.
Happy for you.
Thank you.
As long as you keep doing it, though, because that's the most important thing. Are you still enjoying it? Are you still have that spark?
Yeah. I mean, I think I like doing it. I like making the pieces. And there's a lot of temptation to maybe branch out and have some sort of media empire type of situation.
Yes, megalomaniac.
try to think of how. But I've always dissuaded from doing that because I realize the reason I started doing this was so that I could sit and mix and sound design and make fun stories to listen to. And I really I just like doing it. I feel like I get to do a different story every couple of weeks. There's stories that I'm heavily involved in developing, and I'm sort of in charge of what we do and what we don't do. And it's a very good situation. I don't have to take stuff that I don't want to do.
Well, you've worked for it, though, haven't you, as well? So that's superb. You can do that, which is fantastic. And as I say, a lot of people are aiming to do that. I might start up a podcast called The Lie, and then it would be your opposite. and then we'll see how we go.
It's my same logo, but in like a negative.
Yeah, absolutely. You stole my idea. Yeah. I might actually do that just for fun, see what happens. But yeah, I mean, do you listen to other podcasts as well? Do you listen to other anthology shows yourself?
I don't think I listen. Let me look. I'm going to get up my iTunes. Yeah,
come
and
on.
See.
Give us your top few listens. What have you last listened to?
I listen to a lot of Radiotopia shows. Yeah. But,
you need to step outside of the network. There's beauty.
Yeah.
There's
no, I do listen to other things. Like people send me stuff. I get emails from people and they send me stuff all the time. And I always listen to what they send me.
You heard it here. Quick, bombard him.
But yeah, right. No. I don't always get back because sometimes I do get a lot of emails. Mm-hmm. You know, my favorite podcast is actually called Script Notes Podcast.
Oh, okay.
It's actually not an audio drama podcast, but it's a writing podcast.
Yes.
It's for screenwriters.
Yeah.
Do you listen to that?
Sadly, no. No, I haven't made time for that one, but I know of it. Yes.
It's John August and Craig Mazin. And mm-hmm. I really enjoy it. I think they're really smart guys and I get a lot of helpful advice out of it.
This is it. I do love listening to writing podcasts. I listen to a few actually, but yeah, no, I haven't got around to that one. There's only so many hours in a day. Okay, come on, give us your top audio drama. Is there any there?
I don't listen to it enough.
Sacrilege. It's because you're too busy making it. That's what it is.
I think so. I mean, I listen to stuff, but I think if I like something a lot, then I want to not be influenced by it.
Fair enough. Yes.
I don't know. I guess I kind of do. It would be better if I listened to more.
Okay.
But
that's your mission.
This is a question, like I feel like I always get asked this question in interviews and I always squirm a lot because I don't listen to a lot of stuff because usually when I'm not doing my show I just want to be silent. I have a 20-month-old daughter and she takes all this time and usually when I'm not working I have to take care of her.
Yes, I have the same but it's a 47-year-old husband, so slightly different needs. But
exactly. Yeah,
I'm exhausted. You know,
how do you know I'm 47? I'm 47 years old. That's right. I was just listening to Archive 81, which I think is really good.
Yes, fun. Well, in a macabre, horrible kind of way. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought the acting in Limetown was really good.
Mm-hmm.
I love the acting in Homecoming.
Cool.
That was good.
Yes, yeah.
Life After. I think this had a really brilliant premise.
Yeah. I think anything Mac writes is superb.
Yeah.
Steal the Stars is a recent favorite. Yeah, yeah.
And Steal the Stars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I listen to things all the time, but I'm not clocking them.
Not to worry. I'd like to just ask you, just with regards to the breadth of the season, at what point do you sit down with your stories and decide kind of on order, on what goes where, on are you keeping things? Because are there stories that kind of you initially start to develop and then never happen?
So we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants when we do it. A lot of times we only know like the next two stories.
Okay.
And I mean, working on a bunch of stories and it's sort of like, which one feels like it's the farthest along.
Mm-hmm.
We try to make it so that there's a nice ebb and flow so that like we don't follow a story that's too similar.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes though, I feel lucky to have a story at all go up. It's like, because you know, the double-edged sword of making money, making my living at it, is that we have to constantly be producing stuff and we sell ad times ahead of when we've made anything, you know, like a year ahead of time or 6 months ahead of time, we'll be selling ad times, ad slots for that time. And if we don't have anything to put up, then the advertiser is going to be really upset and we may not get anything more from them again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I don't make money to pay my bills, you know? And so like in the past, we've rerun stuff or we've aired pieces from other people in those time slots. But whenever we do that, we get a lot of complaint.
People are quick to complain, aren't they?
Yeah. And so we can't air very much stuff from other people anymore. We'd rather not, just because it's sort of dilutes the identity of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you rerun stuff, people are like, well, why are you rerunning this? I already have it. If I wanted it, I just go download it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Okay.
And And so
fickle people.
and so there's like, yeah, there's this constant, you have to constantly be on top of the production schedule. Mm. And
it's perpetual.
A lot of times when you're working on a story, you're not sure, it's like a puzzle to solve. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it takes longer to solve the puzzle than you thought it would. Mm-hmm. Or the writer, maybe it's a writer I haven't worked with before, and we're sort of still trying to figure out how best to work together. And
just, yeah, because would you, you take know, would you take submissions from people from all over the place?
If we did, my preference is to develop scripts from the pitch level.
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever, except in one, I can only think of one instance where I really don't take completed scripts to produce. Mm-hmm. It's never been what we do. What our thing is we develop them from the germ of the idea and grow it.
Yes.
In
organically together.
In our writing group.
Yes. Superb.
So my preference would be, if I was going to take an idea, would be to get a pitch that I liked, and then from a writer who I liked, whose work I've heard and think is good, and then have them come to our weekly meetings and have them become a part of our writers group.
Cool. So I can be with you in about 24 hours. Is that okay?
Yeah. No. Right, if you can be in New York. Yeah.
But no, that's exciting. So yeah, I mean, I love that collaborative process that you have, and it's really cool of you to be able to share all these fabulous processes with us. I mean, is there anything you'd like to convey that you haven't said? I think we've covered quite a few hundred million things, haven't we? So I think it remains for me to say thank you so much, Jonathan, for giving up your time. It's been really, really fabulous to talk to you, and hopefully, you know, more people are inspired to perhaps jump in on an anthology writing, because yours, for me, is the pinnacle of it. There's quite a few, and I'm sorry for saying that, because some of my buddies also do produce anthology shows, but you've got to work harder, guys, because the truth is still at the top, as far as I'm concerned. So thank you also to Austin Beach, who edited the show, and to all at the Audio Drama Network. And if you're thinking of making an anthology podcast, do start by listening to this one, because you'll learn a lot very quickly, I think. And that's the truth, ain't it, Jonathan? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Thanks for having me. This is really fun.
Welcome. It was brilliant to talk to you. Look forward to your next stories. Yeah. Thank you. Goodbye.